Hi, this is Bea Jones, a buzzkiller from Liverpool. Join me in listening to Professor Buzzkill bust myths and take names. If you listen to him, you'll never walk alone.
Yes, it's Professor Buzzkill here, busting myths, taking names. You know, so many of you buzzkillers have asked me to do a show about fake news. And this October, with an American presidential election coming up, we thought there would be no better time than to do it to help you get ready for the election. So we apologize in advance a little bit to the international buzzkillers out there, although many of you follow American news very, very closely. Fortunately for all of you, American buzzkillers and international buzzkillers, we have Dr. Michelle Nickerson, who is a history professor at the Loyola University of Chicago, here to talk with us about exactly this, the rise of fake news in American history. Hello, Dr. Nickerson. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, it's good to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, I'm glad you came, and I've read not only some things you've written, but you've given a talk similar to this on other media outlets.
Let me start by saying that, you know, the work that I've done on the history of fake news comes very much out of the classroom. Uh-huh. So I'm a political historian. I'm also a historian of religion and women and gender. But we American historians often teach the history of journalism in our big lecture classes. And so when the problem of fake news started to become acute, it occurred to me that this is something that I and my colleagues talk about often.
Right.
And what we usually do is we start with the beginning of the American Republic and the formation of the first, what we call partisan newspapers. Uh-huh. And we take this story through the end of the Civil War and into the era of what we call yellow journalism or muckraking journalism. And the newspaper industry is a national industry. Mm-hmm. Then as we get later in the 20th century, we see how journalism becomes more professionalized, where veracity and, as we might say, truthiness, to borrow a word from Stephen Colbert, becomes a commodity.
Right.
And then we get to this time in the 21st century where we are once again visited by these problems of fake news and mistrust in information that, brings us to the election in November.
Since you started that way, how about helping us understand what we mean, we meaning academics, by fake news? Is it just stuff that's not true, or is it politically motivated stuff that's not true? Is there something more to it than that?
Well, I think if you want to imagine this historically, it's best to think of fake news on a spectrum between just utter, let's say, confusion or, you know, the tendency by journalists to make news sensationalistic and exaggerate. And then on the other side of the spectrum would be intentional deceit,
right?
Spin. And somewhere in there is are different shades of dishonesty, I guess.
Right.
And I think that we move on the spectrum over time. We move back and forth. And so, for example, I think there are three points in American history where it really became more of a problem than it was in other times of American history. For me, it's the early period of partisan journalism, the first national newspapers, the era of yellow journalism, and then today are the three major points.
Well, let's start with that first period of partisan journalism. What happened then? What was that like?
Well, after the War for Independence and the signing of the Constitution, actually as the Constitution was being signed, the nation went in the direction of political parties, which, of course, the early founders, including George Washington, warned against. But it almost was as if, you know, it could not be avoided. And the ways in which these parties were represented was mostly through their newspapers. There was first the Gazette of the United States, which was the voice of the federal government, the Federalist Party. It was pro-government. And then sort of in response to that, the opposition, which would have been led by Thomas Jefferson, for example, and the emerging Democratic Party or Democratic Republican Party, they started the National Gazette. And this is important not only as the origins of journalism in the Republic, but also because the ways in which people lined up between these newspapers, it was almost as if you were on opposing teams.
Okay.
These papers were unabashedly partisan. They were meant to get their people out to the poll. They were meant to get voters in closer affiliation with them. It's here also where you see people's very strong feelings about politics being expressed and imbibed in by the print. And so I find this to be especially important because if we're talking about busting myths, we really need to get away from the idea that fake news is something new. In fact, it really marks the origins of news, of journalism in the United States.
Yeah, so it's at least in the United States, as far as the United States under this type of government that we've had, fake news is 200 some odd years old.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So things change, but they don't necessarily get, they don't get more truthful as we move into the Civil War and post-Civil War era, which, as you know, marked U.S. industrialization.
Right.
So what you see happen is the invention of the steam press and circulation of the steam press, which makes print way more affordable. It also means that there's a wider readership of American newspapers by women, by immigrants, by non-white people. And what you see happening is the news circulates more. You get more subscribers, but it also gets to be more tabloid and sensationalistic. It's lurid. It's full of spectacle. It's meant to be popular reading. Okay. So it's not necessarily getting more honest. And it's, this is not where you see breaking investigative journalism, changing the news environment yet. That comes later. But it eventually leads us to that second period I was talking about, the yellow journalism period. This is the journalism of the progressive era, of the Gilded Age. That's where we see the dominance of major national newspapers. These newspapers are now corporations, okay? Because, of course, we're seeing the emergence of corporations in the U.S. economy.
And by now, you mean in that period in the 1880s, 1890s?
Yes, in the late 19th century. And the two most important newspapers of this period were published by Pulitzer and Hearst, okay? William Randolph Hearst, who had a number of newspapers ultimately, but his New York Journal was the one that really dominated. And he was constantly in competition with Pulitzer, the New York World. Mm-hmm. And they escalated this yellow journalism, this way of publishing what you might call sensationalistic, titillating news about crimes, about murder and violence and, you know, domestic abuse that people sort of flocked to. It became popular. Hearst was called the peddler of ooze.
Ooze. Oh, God. Yeah.
Yes, that was Hearst. Pulitzer had a cartoon in his newspapers, a regular syndicated cartoon called The Yellow Kid.
Okay.
And The Yellow Kid was this street urchin.
Right.
So, you know, people were reading comics about these poor kids in, you know, the world of New York tenements. And from that word, The Yellow Kid, who became so popular, we get this expression of yellow journalism.
Oh, all right. All right.
But there's another side to this.
Mm-hmm.
Because with this expansion of newspapers and yellow journalism came muckraking.
Okay, now we need to explain to the buzzkillers that muckraking sounds like it's just literally throwing dirt on everything, you know, just getting up. But there's a lot more to that term.
Absolutely. In fact, instead of thinking about it as throwing dirt, think about it as literally raking up the dirt, digging it up.
Raking up the dirt. Okay, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that it is Theodore Roosevelt who coined that term, mostly as a derogatory expression to describe what was happening at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the muckrakers, as we called these newspaper reporters, were very good journalists.
Mm-hmm.
What they did was they tended to go after the wealthiest and most powerful men in society, men like Andrew Carnegie, for the ways in which they were exploiting the working class and making a fortune at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So Ida Tarbell, for example, was famous for the works that she did on Standard Oil.
Right.
These were essentially exposés. And so I see these muckrakers as being important origins of investigative journalists today.
Yeah, they're digging up the muck, the negative aspects of society.
Right, in order to expose it.
In order to expose it, yeah.
And in order for people to do something about it, because mm-hmm. what you probably already know about this period, the Progressive Era, was when Americans began trying to clean up politics.
Right.
They also were trying to uplift society with social programs, government-sponsored programs. They were trying to fix elections that were problematic.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we also see the direct election of senators.
Right.
So
right. Something that's always overlooked in American history.
Absolutely.
But is an extremely important change.
Yes.
But that's another subject. We'll get on that a different day.
Yeah. But, you know, the reason I bring it up is because even as journalism gets more sensational,
mm-hmm.
it's getting more democratic
right.
at the same time, as is American society.
Lowercase d.
Yes.
Right.
Lowercase d. More groups of Americans are getting access to the electoral system. This is the time of the 19th Amendment, of course, the 1920. And even those who are being excluded from democratic processes, including African Americans, I would say especially African Americans, find that the news environment is a place where they can have a voice, because it's in the Progressive Era where you see the circulation of what we call race newspapers, like the Chicago Defender.
All right.
Which
okay.
had, and they're all over in cities across the country. I can't even go into the extent of it, but, you know.
Yeah. Some cities even had two.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, yeah. Yeah.
So, in fact, the Chicago Defender still exists today. It's no longer in print, but it's still available online. But these were incredibly important to Black communities in the era of Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, before we leave this period, I just want to emphasize here this connection between muckraking and yellow journalism and American democracy.
Right, right.
But it's also in this period that you hear for the first time the expression fake news uttered.
Okay.
At least this is the first time I've seen it talked about in just those terms, fake news.
Right. Now, is there a specific incident or a specific issue or specific problem where people start, you know, either inventing or exaggerating or coming up with direct attacks that are so extreme that they're called fake news?
Yes, it is the Spanish-American War.
Right. Okay.
So, as you know, this is the end of the 19th century.
Yeah.
It's a period when the U.S. is expanding its presence and power beyond the United States. And we turn our attention to Cuba, our neighbor, mm-hmm. by 90 miles, because it's where the Spanish Empire is fighting for its life. And we're interested because it's a place where we would prefer to exert our influence. So we are in Cuba, basically watching what's happening. There's a ship called the USS Maine in the harbor of Havana, and nothing's happening.
Right.
There's a great deal of tension, and this is a problem for whom?
Newspapers.
For newspapers.
Yeah, they don't have anything
exactly.
to say. Yeah, they don't have anything to write about. Yeah. Or don't have
right.
enough to write about.
Exactly. So it's the 1890s, and we have this war between Pulitzer and Hearst, and they decide, or I should say it's really Hearst who decides that it's time to kind of make something up to get readers. Mm-hmm. And in 1897, a reporter for the New York World told his boss, Hearst, quote, "Everything is quiet. There is no trouble. There will be no war. I wish to return." And Hearst famously wrote back, quote, "Please remain. You furnish the pictures and I'll furnish the war."
Yeah. Yeah. One of the most famous quotes in that period. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically the newspaper falsely reported that it was Spanish torpedoes that sunk the Maine. And you should know, we really don't know for sure exactly what happened, but 20th century investigations using computer modeling suggests that the explosion came from within the vessel.
Right. Okay.
And it was from like a coal-fired engine.
Right.
But we're pretty sure it was not torpedoes. And we definitely didn't know, or there was really no information to confirm that there were torpedoes at that time. And what it meant was Democrats successfully pushed the president, William McKinley, into the war, which he had wanted to avoid. It meant a 10-week war that ultimately led to U.S. control, not just of Cuba, but Puerto mm-hmm. Rico, Guam, mm-hmm. and the Philippines. And yes, mm-hmm. it was very fruitful for newspapers. Yeah. In fact, then in 1898, finally, a trade press for the newspaper industry lamented, quote, "The public is hardly becoming sick of fake news and fake extras."
This
is where they decided that something had to be done about this because it was becoming a problem for the democracy.
Okay. And we should remind buzzkillers that the USS Maine blows up.
Yes, absolutely. Yes,
and that's an incident in the Spanish-American War. And as you say, there's a good question about why it blows up. But the important thing for our purposes here is that it gets sensationalized as a Spanish attack.
As a Spanish attack, yeah, as if there were Spanish torpedoes that blew up the USS Maine, that blew up our ship.
Well, this is a good time for us buzzkillers to take a little break, because when we come back, we want to talk about the reaction to this, to the rise of this fake news, and then quickly move on to how this sort of plays out in the 20th and 21st centuries. So we'll be back in a second. We have a station ID break, and on the line is Diane from Milwaukee.
Hi, Professor. I'm calling in on behalf of the Cage Free Vegan Society.
Wait, what? They don't put vegans in cages.
They do in Wisconsin, Professor. This is dairy country.
Okay. You can mention the Cage Free Vegan Society.
But that's not what I want to talk about.
Okay.
Buzzkillers and other listeners should go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com and click on support the show. For as little as a dollar a month, listeners can join Buzzkill Society.
Okay, what are the benefits of being a member of the Buzzkill Social Order?
Members of Buzzkill Society get shout outs on the show, chances to win free copies of books, and lots of other goodies like coffee cups and t-shirts at higher levels. Most importantly, they get the immense satisfaction of knowing that they're keeping the Buzzkill social fabric together.
Okay, what's the website again?
ProfessorBuzzkill.com. That's ProfessorBuzzkill.com.
Thanks, Diane. Anything else you want to tell the Buzzkillers?
Yes, free Gwyneth Paltrow.
You're a weirdo, Diane.
Takes one to know one.
Okay, we're back with Dr. Michelle Nicholson from Loyola University of Chicago, history professor there, talking about fake news. And before we left for the break, Professor, you talked about the first appearance of the phrase fake news during the Spanish-American War and during the blowing up of the Maine. And then you started to talk about the reaction to the rise of fake news, or the reaction to the recognition of fake news. What was that? What was that reaction?
Well, that reaction came from a couple quarters. Mm-hmm. First, the U.S. courts. Perhaps you've noticed with the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, more discussion about the history of the Supreme Court.
Right.
Well, at the turn of the century, the court became more interested in protecting private property and helping with the expansion of the U.S. economy. And part of the agenda of this new court was to protect people's privacy. Mm-hmm. And so it began to enforce things like libel laws and also, you know, the prying eyes of reporters was kind of met by judges with limits now that they didn't have before. But then you also see a response by the industry, which begins to sincerely professionalize in ways that it hadn't done before. So we see the formation of Sigma Delta Chi, which was a society.
Right.
It ultimately changes its name to the Society of Professional Journalists, still exists today. And it develops a code of standards by which newspapers and writers begin taking responsibility for veracity, for truthfulness in news. So, for example, they agree to everybody in the society to put welfare of society before newspaper profits, to guard their independence, to be truthful and accurate, to be free from opinion or bias, to protect privacy whenever possible, and to keep news within the bounds of decency. So we also see the establishment and expansion of schools of journalism.
Right.
So one of the most famous being at the University of Missouri. That's established in 1908, followed by Columbia University, Medill at Northwestern. And they become places where professors, then they develop curricula for professionalizing journalists, making them investigators and writers. And then also, as a result, newspapers develop a vast readership over the course of the 20th century.
Okay,
this also is accelerated by the growth of the economy in the 1920s. So most famously, the New York Times. When the Oakes family took over the Times in the 1920s, they added that now famous byline, all the news that's fit to print.
Right.
And that was really a sideswipe at the yellow journalism of the earlier period. So credibility becomes important to writers, to their career, to their reputations. And as I mentioned before, truth becomes a commodity. People want to get closer to what actually happened.
Okay. This is was one of the biggest revelations to, in your a talk you gave on this before that I heard, that you say truth in news becomes a commodity to be sold. It's something that, in effect, newspapers could advertise that they were better at than other newspapers.
Yes.
And that's a kind of a new thing. Is it partly because of this rise in ethics? Or is it partly because of the rise of professionalism? Or is it mainly, is it also because there are people in the business or the accounting department saying, ha, 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 we've got an angle now we can use.
Yes. Okay. There's almost certainly there were newspapers before the 1920s that took this seriously.
Yeah.
But what you see happening is it becomes so much more profitable.
Right.
It allows organizations like the New York Times to get really big and to be able to do things that they couldn't do before in terms of investigation and in terms of a national readership. You also have the Washington Post, then the Los Angeles Times starting a little bit later, and they're read far and wide, and they're taken seriously as the most important voices in American news. It becomes important to the formation of a national community and national identity as people begin to see themselves reflected in stories that are written, you know, thousands of miles away, and they begin to identify more with national communities. And this carries through most of the 20th century, though I do have to say that it's not as if false reporting disappeared.
No, yeah.
It just becomes more important to people to identify that and be careful of it.
And I suppose with the expansion of all sorts of necessary government structures because of World War I and World War II, this is just, there's just even more and more and more.
Yes. Yeah. So things get dicey during World War I and World War II. And something actually that happens in any era of warfare where governments start to assert more control over news.
Right.
And Americans who tend to feel insecure, either because, you know, their sons and eventually sons and daughters are sent overseas for warfare, or they feel insecure in terms of their safety at home, they let the government do these things.
Yeah.
They let the government pass laws that control information. So during World War I and World War II, the US government becomes more aggressive in prosecuting dissent, and they establish organizations, or I should say, they establish committees and bureaucracies to control information, mm-hmm. like the Committee on Public Information.
Right, right.
This is one of the ways in which the US government fights what we call total warfare. That is warfare that gets everybody involved in the war, from soldiers to wives to children to teachers. Everybody has something to do with whatever they buy, with their volunteer work, etc. And it proves very successful for the United States in both the First and Second World War. And it's partly because of how the United States managed to control information. Mm-hmm. And we see this in later wars too.
Okay, so you said a second ago that you know, despite all this rise of professionalism, and then despite all the expansion of newspapers and truth being a commodity, and then this added sort of government propaganda and censorship, you said before that yellow journalism doesn't disappear
right
in the 20th century.
Right.
How does that happen? You would think that a rational person might think that with all this quality news around, that the garbage news, the yellow journalism, would sort of fall out of favor.
Well, I guess I should back up and say it's really false news or false reporting that persists. You know, I feel like in many ways, yellow journalism did persist in tabloids, for example.
Right.
But Americans started to separate those things. There was, you know, national reputable news organizations, and then there were the other tabloids that Americans could, you know, distinguish between what they look like and what they were buying. But part of the problem here is who Americans turn to as authoritative sources in American society.
Okay.
So one of the things that you might or might not know is that it's not against the law for the president of the United States to tell a lie to the American people.
Right.
So for example, during the Vietnam War, at the onset of US escalation of the Vietnam War, President Lyndon Johnson actually just flat out lied to Americans on television, on the national networks, when he said that US ships had been attacked off the coast in the Gulf of Tonkin. This is in August of 1964. And hundreds of pages of National Security Agency documents that are released much later, 2005, make it abundantly clear there was no attack on the United States. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but the people there, I should say, the Americans who were present and witnessing this, knew that there was no attack. James Stockdale, who worked right there in Vietnam for the Navy, said, quote, "I had the best seat in the house to watch the event, and our destroyers were just shooting at phantom targets. There were no PT boats there. There was nothing but black water and American firepower." The problem is that presidents and others have so much authority that we know it happened again after 9/11 during the War on Terror, mm-hmm. when the Bush administration was making the case for an invasion of Iraq.
Right.
Because he and others in the White House argued that we needed to go there because Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the dictator, was hiding weapons of mass destruction. Not only that, but Pulitzer Prize winning journalists like Judith Miller at the New York Times simply accepted this information coming out of the White House as fact. They didn't scrutinize it. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, we can fairly criticize the New York Times at that time as being sort of like an organ of state news that allowed the president, as presidents have done in the past, to falsify information for political purposes. So that's what I mean by false reporting.
Right. Because, and we can go all the way back and say that the USS Maine is an incident, mm-hmm. and remember the Maine is an incident. Mm-hmm. The Gulf of Tonkin is such an incident.
Yes.
The weapons of mass destruction is an incident. And by the time, as the famous saying goes, the truth catches up, it's far too late.
And also, this is why I urge you to think about this on a spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
For example, what did the White House know and not know about weapons of mass destruction?
Right.
Did the president really think they were there? Was it was it lies or was it willful denial?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Did he really want them to be there? Did he really? I don't know.
Yeah.
All I know is that the work was not done to verify that they were there, either by our government, our military, or the critics in the journalism business.
Right. Now, during all this time, of course, not in Vietnam, but certainly the war in Iraq, there's also what we're going to, and the war, eventually the war on terror, there's also the rise of cable TV news.
Yes.
How did that rise work, say, in, did it work in a similar way to the rise of these major newspapers in the 20s, like you talked about? Or is it something so totally new that, it's a whole other ballgame?
Well, it's similar to what happens at the turn of the 20th century in that you get these news corporations. They're big businesses. They're media businesses. They're giants mm-hmm. in the American economy.
Mm-hmm.
So starting with CNN, eventually Fox News, they, like the newspapers once did, come to dominate the media landscape. People tune in and they tend to affiliate themselves with particular news organizations in terms of their partisanship
mm-hmm.
and in terms of who they come to believe. But what you see happening then, along with news radio, is the polarization of the landscape. And so Americans are either on one side or another. So as we grow more red versus blue, so do these cable news shows. Whereas at one point we saw the network news through the three stations as more or less the national news.
Yeah, sure.
Right? We either tuned into World News Tonight or Nightly News. That becomes a thing of the past, whereby people who are Democrats or liberals or progressives, they tend to follow either CNN or MSNBC. And if you're conservative, you tend to watch Fox News. So that's how it changes journalism.
And of course, as you say, as you said a second ago, is also talk radio follows that same sort of pattern.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, no, talk radio is very much dominated by the right.
Oh, so yes. Yeah. But the extremism, it's all this or it's nothing, you know, it's all.
Yeah.
The demonization of political opponents, things have to be absolutely correct in their version of the world. And therefore, everyone who doesn't believe that is then trashed on the radio.
Not only that, but we see the emergence of what's called breaking news and 24-hour news. So whereas you once had deadlines for newspapers mm-hmm. where, you know, they would be printed way early in the morning and circulated, or you would watch once a day. People can watch news all day now.
Yeah.
You know, you can work in an office where you have the TV tuned into a news station all the time. And so there's a great deal of pressure on these organizations to put something out there. And again, to be sensationalistic, to tap into people's emotions, to get their attention,
mm-hmm.
to keep viewers tuned in.
Now, is the rise of social media in the 21st century, is this another sort of avenue?
Yes. In fact, I think it's social media is as transformative to the news as cable TV
mm-hmm.
and as the rise of newspapers at the turn of the century. It's changing quickly and it's changing so much that we really don't have a grip on it. And that's the problem that we have right now. That's the danger we face in the information that's circulating in the United States today and beyond.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, when you can see sort of public opinion when you watch, for instance, these presidential debates during this election, if you've got your Twitter feed rolling, you can kind of see a national conversation or an international conversation reacting immediately to what's being said.
Unfortunately, I don't know about you, but yeah, my Twitter feed is not national. It's very partisan, right? I'm not being fed.
Well, that's, I think a lot of people are that way too. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not being fed what conservatives are saying. It's everybody I follow on the left. I do follow people who are conservative, but their tweets are not appearing in my feed. So this is one of the problems.
Oh, that's interesting.
With social media, that's interesting. Okay, is the ways in which algorithms are controlling what we see. The other problem is the short, you might say, bursts of news that they represent. So when you tweet or when you write something in Facebook, you have how many words? 145 words. Therefore, there is
characters. I think not even words.
Characters. Right. And so you don't have context. So you put something out there and it just has to stand on its own two legs. People are reading it. People who don't even know you know nothing about you. And it's not part of an overall conversation that we once had about these topics. So that becomes a problem. And it's one of the reasons why kind of the more extremist expressions tend to get out there more quickly. And then of course there's the problem of, you know, intentional misinformation.
Right.
What coming closer now to what we actually call fake news at this moment in the 21st century.
My final question to you is what a lot of our listeners have asked me, and that is there anything Americans can do about this?
I think there is, and I think we have to develop a response to this in a systematic and ongoing way. Mm-hmm. I think, first of all, the people who are listening to this are people who already take it seriously as a problem and are already attuned to the tools that you need to develop in your reading of the news to protect us as a society from misinformation. But I think one of the most useful things I've found recently is a system developed by the Institute for the Future Digital Intelligence Lab. This is a 501c3 nonprofit organization called Building a Healthy Cognitive Immune System.
Cognitive immune system. I like that very much. Yeah.
Yes, me too. I do too. I saw Thomas Friedman had put it out there in the Times, and I like it. It basically helps you to understand misinformation as something like a virus that's attacking our democracy, and then to think about what you have to do to protect yourself and your community from that information. Think about these attacks is kind of like a parasite that is most dangerous to the parts of our society that find themselves vulnerable. For example, social media is obviously a very vulnerable place, a place in which we are most likely to find false information. Media parasites, she says, the writer of this article, her name's Marina Gorbis, says that we have to be aware of confirmation bias as a place, as something that makes us vulnerable. That is our tendency to selectively seek and interpret information to confirm our existing beliefs. We all do it.
Right.
In fact, this really also calls into question any kind of journalism that purports to be completely unbiased. Everybody brings a bias. The question is, how well do people bring awareness to and reckon with the biases that they bring to their work as journalists and that we bring to the work of reading and culling information through newspapers and other forms of media? We need to develop stronger independent media platform review bodies, things like Snopes that help us to fact check and to see and evaluate which sources tend to be more honest than others, where we can get better information. We need to protect and proliferate public media platforms.
Right.
Things like NPR, one of my favorites is Mapping Prejudice. These are nonprofit platforms that are funded either through the public or through public universities. And they're there to make us more literate and media savvy, to help us understand the relationship between history, the present, and the future. We need to develop early warning systems. In fact, I think a good example of this is how we now are way more sophisticated in how we recognize and deal with bots in social media, mm-hmm. you know, false accounts. Okay. That's
yeah. These are the accounts that can generate content.
Yes.
Just at a zillion times the speed of light, practically. They just go crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, think of, you know, I have a Twitter handle. These would be Twitter handles for computers, you know, generated personalities,
right, not
even people. Avatars,
right?
Well, we're way more on to this kind of influence in our elections, for example. Well, we have to get better about flagging these problems early on and then turning our attention now to, you know, the newer problems for our upcoming election, where stories are planted in different ways and circulated, even through live journalists who are baited by Russian organizations and government agencies to circulate false news. So those would be my recommendations. And the last thing would be what I call the triangulation of information gathering. And I teach this to my students, that you have your most reliable sources of news. For me, it's NPR, the New York Times, the Washington Post. But when I see something that looks like an argument or that looks partisan, or I go to the other side to verify the information.
Right. Okay.
I'll go to Fox News. I'll go to the National Review, and I like to see what other people have to say about it. So before you put anything out there, see what other people, what other organizations are saying about what you're about to accept as the verified truth.
Well, that's important. I think very interesting, because you talk initially about the fake news being sort of a spectrum.
Yes.
Right. We should think about that in historical terms. Anyway, it's a spectrum. Then there's this triangulation,
mm-hmm.
right, which sort of means then you have to look at what you're reading and being suspicious about, as that could be on a spectrum too.
Right.
And only way to find out where it is on the spectrum is to read the other things.
Let me give you
things.
I'll give you an example. So here's something about my confirmation bias. The news junkie that I am, I love to read stories in the New York Times, mm-hmm. Washington Post about White House intrigue. And, you know, they definitely get me with these reports about people close to the president who are saying this and that. And the problem is, I often notice that these sources are never identified, right? This would somebody who's speaking, not off the record necessarily, but someone who does not want to be identified, and they're leaking information.
Uh-huh.
So there are ways in which leaks can be valuable, but when they're just put out there, they have to be scrutinized. They have to be taken for what they are. They're unverified reports. And the news organizations that do follow up are the ones, I think, that have the most credibility. So let's take, for example, the release of the tax returns.
This is President Trump's tax returns.
Yes.
This is a breaking New York Times story, late September, early October.
Fortunately for us, we have news organizations in the country with the resources to do that kind of work. It's breathtaking investigation.
Mm-hmm.
It's only valuable, though, to the extent that these things can be verified.
Right.
And even though we ourselves we can't put our hands on these documents yet, there are ways that the Times and other organizations can follow up on this information to get as close to it as they possibly can. And of course, to see how President Trump and others around him deny or defend the story that's printed, that's put out there against them.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, we know it'll come out eventually, but you know, it's news like that that we have to handle very carefully when we hear it.
Right, right. Well, it just remains for me to say thank you so much, Professor. Not only have you explained the background and the history and the context of all these things, you've given us excellent resources in which to start filtering and trying to understand where we fit on these various spectrum and to read news better. And we've put links to these organizations and these websites on the blog post for this episode. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And we will say to the rest of you buzzkillers out there that we'll talk to all of you next week.